Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined again by Phil Brining and the returning Joe Kirk. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
So this week's session was on PECA, including cookies and direct marketing specifically. And we delved into, you know, the common issues that we face or that we see when it comes to cookies on websites, direct marketing, the complexities of that. It was a really good session as ever. Loads of contributions, you know, some people are muting at the end of the session to give their opinions. And yeah, it was some good debate.
Yeah, I thought it was good. We spent a lot of time on cookies, didn't we? And pixels and those types of techniques. A little bit on email marketing. We talked a bit about the soft opt-in, didn't we? And the charities and you know, our opinions on how that works. And we didn't really talk much about telephone marketing. You know, I don't know if there's a lot of that, but it was quite interesting talking through, you know, which is the most intrusive. You know, why are the rules tighter for electronic marketing than they are for phone marketing? And then we didn't talk at all about some aspects like the automated dialers and we didn't fax marketing. Anybody use fax? Well, you don't know what fax is, do you? Location data. We didn't talk about marketing lists. We didn't talk about, I'm telling you what we didn't talk about. What did we talk about?
That's why it's leading up to the second session that we need to confirm the dates for. But a part of the session that I found really interesting was trying to decide what the intention of the PECA is. You know, is the intention to reduce the, we compared, for example, telephone marketing to email marketing, and why there's more stringent controls around email marketing. Is it because there's capacity to send out multiple communications at a much quicker and easier rate? Or is it the intrusiveness? And would you consider, you know, telephone marketing more intrusive? Because I've never really considered that when it comes to PECA, but it does raise questions.
Yeah, I think we need to have another session. I think I agree with having another session, because there's loads of, you know, stuff, again, we touched on, like remarketing and all these techniques that are common practice. You know, I think it's useful just to stop and have a look at them and, you know, turn them over and discuss, you know, whether the law has been applied correctly to them. Just because it happened doesn't mean to say they're happening lawfully. And, you know, just trying to kind of make some sense and break them down to their component parts. So, well, that's this part of it, and that's obviously, you know, legitimate interest, and that's that part of it, and that has to be consent. Yeah. And this is this part of it, and, you know, Article 14 is engaged here because of. So I think that again would be quite a fun thing to chew over.
I think next time as well, I created some time ago a table of the different requirements for, you know, the different forms of communication. I could share that as well, because it breaks down, you know, the different kinds of email marketing communications to individuals or to you know, to corporate email addresses, and then, you know, the different requirements around telephone. Yeah.
So I meant to say that we've developed a flowchart that people can contact us if they want a copy of. So we have a decision-making flowchart where you can follow it through. I want to do this, and you basically follow it through the flowchart. It tells you whether you can or you can't do it, or what you've got to do to comply with the PECA. And I also meant, and I'm disappointed in myself for not remembering, mention that we also have a PECA masterclass, don't we, part of our training suite. And again, if it's a complex area, and if anybody wants to kind of do a half a day's kind of study on it effectively, then that might be something that might be of interest.
Yeah, some direct marketing for you there. So anyway, we'll let you all listen to the actual session before we end up doubling the length of it. So we hope you enjoy, and yes, stay on the lookout for a second session. Before we start, the session is recorded, so if you've got any problems with that, there's a posting notice on screen, and just message us after the session. So what have we seen in the news this week?
Well, I've seen a few things, actually. A couple of things. One is there was a news report in the BBC about CCTV cameras to two particular Chinese makers, but these are the world leaders, Hikvision and Dahua. But apparently, it's very easy to hack into and control the cameras. So these are the cameras that are installed in city centres and some of the government offices and so on and so forth. So that was quite worrying. That was a Panorama investigation team that found that, and they found it was really easy to hack into them and get control of them, and either just sit and watch what's going on or to start to control the cameras. So places where these cameras are installed are the Department for International Trade, the Department for Health, the Department for DEFRA, the Army Reserve centres. So, you know, some quite sensitive sites, really. So that was like, whoa, that was interesting.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
I didn't see that, no, but it does sound like they didn't do sufficient due diligence on the CCTV companies to ensure that that doesn't happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're back to, you know, how do you do due diligence on these kind of, you know, purchasing agreements? I mean, if let's say it's just a purchasing agreement and you're not actually appointing Hikvision as a processor, then, you know, you're buying equipment, aren't you?
So, I suppose, then, yeah, so you're liable.
Yeah, so what level of due diligence do you go into as well with that? You know, do you see it as an assurance of, yeah, we've got this in place, yeah, we've got this tick box exercise, or do you actually audit the systems themselves and get into, you know, get into that?
Interesting. But I mean, sorry, go on.
I'm just thinking, though, say for an Army Reserve base or for government offices, you know, maybe that is a reasonable step, but I don't know.
Who knows? But apparently the information, again, we talked about freedom of information the other week, didn't we? I can't remember if we did or didn't, but the basically Panorama seemed to have made, or Big Brother Watch made a freedom of information request to public authorities, like 4,500 freedom of information requests, and 1,200 responded, and of those 1,200, 806, which is a high proportion, confirmed that they did use Hikvision or Daiwa cameras. I mean, it could be that there's other camera makers that have also got that kind of vulnerability built in.
Yeah, it's a possibility, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was interesting. I saw, have you ever heard of a flipping, not flipping, you've heard of that all the time, haven't you? A flipper zero.
No. What's that?
No. Well, it's nothing to do with dolphins either. It's a portable hacking device which will basically read RFID signals. So when people, you know, unlock their cars or lock their cars or, you know, scan a card or, you know, point a key fob at a garage door or that kind of stuff, then these flipper hacking devices actually read the signal. They can replay them back, of course.
Right.
So that means and anyway, Flipper, the company behind it, is a Russian business. It's on target to make £80 million in sales this year.
I'm not surprised, because it's very common, isn't it, that nowadays that not many cars, especially the newer ones, don't have keys, do they? And they operate in that way. So that doesn't surprise me really, Phil, that that's you know, a hot topic and someone's taken advantage of that.
No. So this was a report I read on TechCrunch, a blog called TechCrunch. And the person writing the report said, you know, the system really works too. He says, I'm not much of a hacker, but I've been able to open people's garages, activate elevators and other locking systems that should well be beyond this person's hacking skill. He said it's quite good fun. I think they've sold of these devices so far, and apparently Tesla charging ports can be unlocked using these things as well. So anyway, the person writing the article said that he's now run into a problem because it's requiring a software update, you know, firmware update, and he's terrified of plugging it into his computer because it's a hacking device made in Russia. He's thinking that maybe if he plugs it into his computer, it might cause him a problem. But again, that's worrying, isn't it? These devices are about, you know, and you can buy them, and you know what does that mean? It means that all this type of RFID keyless locking is, again, if somebody can read those signals, then they can replay them.
I mean, that's just the nature of it, isn't it? You know, as technology becomes more advanced, so does the efforts and skills of cyber criminals.
Yeah, and it seems to me that often the people designing the tech solutions don't appreciate how advanced the hacking community is. So you read all sorts of things, don't you, that these systems are really quite vulnerable, like gaming devices and Internet of Things devices. You know, they're particularly notorious for being vulnerable. But, you know, are we underestimating the hackers when we're building this stuff? Why aren't we making them more secure? Is it, you know, profit and price pressure that brings down, well, we'll take this bit out, or don't develop that bit, don't test it that bit? that much extra probably. Just because, yeah, because of the cost of it. I don't know. Bring to market quickly.
My friends just had their car stolen through that system.
Really?
So they got the car. They've reprogrammed the car. Car's been recovered, but now they can't program it back. So their car is basically stuck in limbo. They can't have it back because it doesn't work with their key. It can't be reprogrammed. And the insurance company won't pay out because it's been recovered.
Oh, dear. What a situation to be in.
What's wrong with the old-fashioned key, eh?
Well, it's this technology, kind of, it can be done, so let's do it.
Yeah, and they've not thought, have they, of the possibilities of that happening, for example, that Claire's just informed us of.
Yeah, but it's worrying, isn't it? I mean, Toby's making a point. I think we've talked about this before, about security on cars. You know, what you read is it seems particularly poor. But it's never been that great, has it? I mean, when I was young, you used to be able to, not I did, you know, people used to stick coat hangers through the door frames and hook up the, anyway.
I've seen a Top Gear episode where they get old 80s cars and Jeremy gets the indicator, like, button. He takes it out, flips it upside down and plugs it in, and the ignition on the car starts. And all you got to do is get a bump and, you know, a little bump from your mates and off you go.
Yeah, no, I've seen that. I have a car, to be fair, an 80s car that you can unlock the door with a teaspoon. The key is just so rubbish. You just push a teaspoon and turn it and it unlocks.
Is that at your house now, is it, Phil?
No, not to me.
I was going to say, don't be surprised if it disappears in the coming week.
Yeah, no, it's all right, because I've got one of those remote control garage doors, so it should be absolutely fine.
Yeah.
Yes, keep your car keys in a Faraday pouch, says Bev. Quite right. The other thing I saw, have you seen anything yourselves? But the other thing I saw, which really quite appealed to a kind of a dark sense of humour, really, is that there's about 100 French drivers who have filed a complaint over driving through London's low emission zone because they've been hit with fines. One person been fined up to £18,000 for driving through the low emission zone. And anyway, the Euro Car Parking Collection, this company, has tracked them down and sent them all penalty notices. And of course, the furore is that over the fact that since we left the European Union, there is no data sharing agreement between this company and the French and the Belgian driver vehicle registration authority equivalent. So they made a complaint to the CNIL, the French regulator. Which quite interesting. Some people have already paid the fine, so that's that's characterising that as they've already had financial harm, and just and then they might have stress, and they're all worried if they come back to England, they might have their cars impounded. So I'm really quite interested to see how this one plays out. And I have a particular dislike of these parking companies. I think it's that they're awful actually. They're awful. I don't know if you saw that in the press.
Yeah. So by that, are you hinting that the individuals that have been affected might be looking to get some sort of compensation, obviously because they've had harm?
Yes. So they've made a complaint to the CNIL, and the CNIL might come back and say, look, the data hasn't been processed lawfully. It's not fair processing. It's not lawful processing. You need to destroy it or whatever they might say. But then there also might be a case for damages about the recovery of the fines already paid, and then potentially the distress caused by being hounded by this Euro, whatever they're called, parking collection company.
Yeah, I think I saw that in the news, actually. I put some notes on it, but I think you've covered everything there, to be fair. I also saw in the news, actually, about ad tech giant Criteo issued a revised fine of 40 million from 60 million. And it's quite relevant to today's session, really. So they were fined in the end 40 million over failings to garner users' consent around targeted advertising. In August 2018, the CNIL reached a preliminary decision that Criteo had breached the GDPR and issued the fine, which was then reduced.
60 million, I'm on to it. We talked about this last week, actually, whilst you were you here last week, or were you swanning about?
I was off.
Oh, you were off. You were swanning about. I think we talked about that last week, Criteo, because I remember us discussing that it's like 3% of their global annual turnover, and they were complaining that Facebook's fine was like 0.07%. But anyway, yes, we saw that, Jasmine. And that was, again, quite, as I say, interesting and relevant. Joe, what have you been up to this week? Have you seen anything in the news, or have you been hiding under a rock?
Kind of, because I was off Monday, Tuesday, but I did see something around G7 data protection authorities point to key concerns on generative AI. The regulators set out to outline a common vision of data protection challenges of generative AI models like ChatGPT. And the Data Protection and Privacy Authority of the UK, France, Germany, Italy, US, Canada and Japan met last week for a G7 roundtable to discuss free data flows, enforcement, cooperation and emerging technologies. I thought that was quite interesting. I think they said that we recognise that there are growing concerns that generative AI may prevent risks and potential harms to privacy, data protection and other fundamental human rights if not properly developed and regulated, was what they said in a joint statement.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the rage, isn't it? And I think quite right. Yeah. It's a very, very powerful tool. Although I asked it the other day, I was just messing about with ChatGPT this week, actually. And I asked it about transfers to the US from the UK. And according to ChatGPT, there's an adequacy agreement in place, which was news to me.
Yeah. I'm surprised it didn't say it rely on the Privacy Shield framework.
No, it knows that doesn't exist anymore, but it does think there's an adequacy agreement in place. So that was, it just shows you, I guess, how wrong it can be.
Yeah, I mean, the more I've, you know, tested it with data protection related questions, the less I trust it. I think it's more wrong than it is right, to be honest. I think it might be good, you know, for I don't know, like a creative element, you know, if you use it in that aspect, but for actual factual information, I don't trust it. Mm.
Yeah, because the law's constantly changing, isn't it? So if it's scraping things off the internet to use as its information to provide to the people, then it's going to have things that contradict itself, isn't it? Because it will find that some people do still rely on the Privacy Shield, although they shouldn't because it's invalid. You know, they'll think that might be appropriate still. And then, like you say there, Phil, that they might still think that there's there's an adequate decision in place when there's not.
Well, as you say, it's probably absorbed a lot of information. And they need like a blue tick thing like Twitter have gone. You would be my blue tick. So if Joe Kirk says that there isn't an adequacy agreement, I would, right, okay, that takes precedent over all the pieces of text you find.
I've asked it before, you know, what information it uses, whether it can access social media accounts and things like that. And it said... Bert said in the chat that Joe is law. it said that it can access, you know, any public information. So public accounts, you know, like including statuses and things like that, it'll take into consideration, which we need to be careful. Yeah.
Does the heart on Joe need to pay rise? So she's gaining momentum.
That was me. That was
hashtag
me.
Joe needs to pay rise soon.
I do appreciate that, but I'm a little conscious of the time. We're 15 minutes in already, and often we do run out of time. So I think it might be worth us switching to the main topic of today's session, which is cookies and direct marketing. Is there a particular one you want to start with?
No, not really. I mean, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, you know, are we clear on what the pecker is and where it's come from, and you know, and then what it does. I mean, hopefully everybody is, but we could maybe talk about that a bit, and then you know, we got to unpack the direct marketing piece, haven't we, and how that's characterized and defined. I mean, we talked this week about cookies, didn't we, Joe, and tracking pixels, and you know,
yeah.
Is there anything specifically you want to cover off today, or anybody wants us to cover off today?
I think we'd benefit from the Metapixel stuff because that's something that I'm not too familiar with. I think cookies is relatively straightforward. You know, the rules are governed under Regulation 6 of PECA. You know, and they quite clearly set out that you must receive consent from the individual before you place that cookie on the user's device, unless it is an essential cookie. And obviously, I think people do get a little bit mistaken with marketing cookies. They're not essential. I think it's worth mentioning that because some people try and cut corners, I think, you find with cookies and trying to place things without people's consent, which obviously is a breach of Regulation 6.
Mm. So obviously this has been around for some time, hasn't it? This is like 20 years, in fact, because it was 2003 that the PECA came into effect in the UK, and that implemented the e-privacy directive, as it was known. I can't remember the exact number of the e-privacy directive. So European law, and it's been amended, I don't know how many times, 15 times. I mean, one of the biggest amendments was in 2009 when the cookie law came, you know, called the cookie law then, when that came into effect. That was that regulation six. Kind of, and then location data is regulated by it. You should look at location data when it's triangulated. So again, there's quite a lot of nuances to it, because according to the ICO, you know, the GPS location data collected from a mobile device isn't regulated by the PECA, but GPS triangulation of devices is. So again, we kind of need to be aware of that little nuance as well, that you need to kind of know the technique that you're using if you're doing location data. Using private Wi-Fi triangulation also isn't covered by the PECA. It's only kind of public authorities doing it that is. And the PECA came in and it replaced quite a bit of other legislation, mostly telecoms type legislation. So you know, it came out. So you're talking about cookies, Joe. So you know, this is just more than cookies, though, isn't it? So I mean, hopefully everyone knows what a cookie is. You know, but it's not so much the cookies. What's prohibited is the writing to people's devices and the reading from people's devices, whether it's laptops or phones or whatever, isn't it?
Yeah. So you can't place that cookie, can you, without the consent, unless it's essentially necessary for the function of that website itself.
Yeah. And I mean, people are already in the chat saying, you know, that's a really good point. Like, you know, what is this legitimate interests for unnecessary cookies bit? You know, that's like how. But I mean, I think that's a really good point. I mean, what I think is that what they're trying to do is say, I think what they're trying to do is get away with murder. But I think what they're trying to do is say, you know, if you do consent to us collecting the data, then we're going to be posting it for these purposes, which is based on legitimate interests. But I uncheck everything on all these things. What gets my go as well is when you go back to the same website, you know, 5 minutes later, and you get presented with this enormously long cookie statement again. Well, why? I've already made my decision, you know.
Yeah.
Frustrating. They are frustrating. And in that respect, the Data Protection Bill is right. You know, this is the way it's being implemented is burdensome to people.
Yeah. Alice has put in the chat that she says sometimes when she declines cookies, that they'll block the access on the website. And obviously that's trying to push her into giving consent, which isn't freely given. So therefore, the consent's invalid anyway. So I'm not really sure what these organisations are trying to do. I guess you're right, Phil. They're trying to cut corners, aren't they, and make it easier for them.
Beth's made a good point. Yeah, Beth's made a good point saying that it's often US-based sites that do that. My thoughts with it is that, especially compared to the GDPR, the legislation on cookies is really straightforward. All you need is a cookie policy that tells people what they are, what cookies you're using, and obtains consent. And then a cookie banner that collects valid consent gives you the opportunity to provide consent or withdraw it and whatnot. But even though some websites, it seems, intentionally don't comply with that, maybe because they're US based or another reason, you know, by relying on legitimate interests and not giving the opportunity to withdraw and so on, a lot of organizations that even I deal with, they aren't aware of, you know, the cookie compliance on the website. They'll leave it to web developers to set up and then they won't check it for past that. You know, it's something that doesn't come into people's minds. They think that it's okay once it's set up and, you know, it needs reviewing, really.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, the other thing that is interesting about what you've just described, that process, is that might work well for websites, but it doesn't work at all well for email marketing with pixels and beacons and so on and so forth embedded in them. So, you know, so having a cookie policy on the website for people who are landing on your website for the first time, you know, hit them with a cookie policy, hit them with a cookie banner, fine. But what about subsequently doing you know, email? That cookie policy has to be presented to people in multiple ways as well. Otherwise, you know, how are you able to say it's fair processing?
No, that's a very good point.
So I agree with you that I find that it's often web developers that determine which cookies, first party or third party, are being deployed on a website, particularly third party cookies. But the responsibility is still with the data controller to make sure they know what's being used on their website.
I've done a few cookie reviews actually for some of our customers recently. So checking what cookies are placed when I, you know, consent to all of them being placed, and then those that are taken off when I withdraw. And I've seen a few times that there's been inconsistencies with placement of cookies on particular devices, my device, sorry. So say, for example, I was to consent into the placement of the cookies and it would place all the cookies onto my device. I would then alter the preferences and take it off, taking them all off other than the necessary cookies. But then when I consent back in, it's a different list of the cookies that I originally consented to in the first place. So I think it's really important that what you're stating in your cookie policy of the cookies that are being placed on the device matches up with that of the cookies that are actually placed on the device.
Yeah, that could be down what tool you're using to track it, because that could be down to the tool you're using.
Yeah, possibly. Just using the more developer tool, and you know, Google Chrome developer tools, right, more tools on there on the left hand side. It lists the cookies, doesn't it?
Yeah, because I found like Ghostery, I used to use it, but I find it really inaccurate. It doesn't go far enough for this. So I was looking at tools the other day. We've got a piece of work to do, a really detailed forensic cookie analysis of some websites. So I was looking at what would be, you know, a really good cutting edge tool to use.
Do you have any recommendations?
No, I haven't concluded my work yet. Actually, we haven't got a piece of work. Dave said we might have a piece of work, so at the moment it's like speculative. So but you know, if we're going to do it, we need to have, you know, probably two or three different tools applied to make sure we don't get any variations between the results from the tools. But Ghostery, in my views, you know, only shows you part of the story.
Yeah, and if anyone else in the chat has got recommendations regarding, you know, devices that we can use to track cookies, please chuck them our way, because, you know, we'd like to know.
Well, we'll share them as well.
Yeah. I'm not sure if Generate, I mentioned it, you know, probably a few months ago. Yeah. On the podcast, but that I don't know if that would be able to track cookies, because that is used, you know there's two modes to it. There's the secure mode, the private mode, and then there's the I guess the rewards mode, where you can, you know, keep your cookies on and allow anonymous, you know, your information anonymized to be shared and analyzed and whatnot, and then you can get rewards for that. It just gives you some control over how your information is handled. You download it onto your phone or device, and you can either get rewards for sharing your information, or you can keep it completely private. So I've got it. And
Jazz, is that the thing you spoke about a few months ago that was on Dragon's Den?
Yeah, it was on Dragon's Den. Yeah. I've got it, but to be fair, I've not looked at it in a while. I maybe times were tough, I don't know. I had it on rewards mode just to see how it would go. I've not checked it. I wanted to forget and see what I've built up, but I'll let you know next week.
We'll hold you to that. We'll hold you. Now, of course, Google have announced they're phasing out third-party cookies, didn't they, and replacing it with other technologies. But I think they pushed that back to, they were going to do it this year, weren't they, 2023? Mm-hmm. I think they pushed that back. Are you up to speed with? I'm not thinking. Are you up to speed with where they're up to with that?
No, not particularly. But I did see that Google have faced new antitrust charges by EU regulators. So I'm not sure how that will progress. But you know, it continues. The saga continues.
Yeah. Toby's saying that Google Tag Assistant for Google Analytics isn't necessarily that accurate either. But we talked this week, didn't we, about tracking pixels, Joe, and trying to, you know, describe how they were working was interesting. And I'm not sure I fully got it, if I'm being honest, because I thought I really understood how they worked. You know, you got a small pixel in an outbound HTML email, and when somebody opens the pixel, it calls for the image, you know, which is a 1x1 clear image, you know. But in doing so, you know, it'll communicate with the server serving the image and say, right, you know, this IP address, this device's OS, and potentially other information has called for this image. So then you know that that person has opened your email and theoretically has read it. But when in the ICO's guidance, I haven't got it up to hand right now, but the ICO is talking about tracking pixels being stored on people's devices, which I suppose they are, aren't they? Because they're embedded in the email. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So when it gets onto your email client, you know, then it's stored on a device. But if you open it from a browser, it probably isn't stored on a device, is it? It's probably stored in the email system of like Google Mail or whatever you're using, Gmail.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're working a different way, and it's really the amalgamation of data on the server that's the bit that allows for the analysis and the tracking of behavior, you know, over a period of time. So I did a project for a company quite a few years ago now, looking at, it was something called the Adobe Marketplace, and that again was Adobe pixels embedded in web page and emails, and you know, I got trained on how to use this Adobe analytics platform. It is quite a few years ago now, and I was amazed at how much data was available and how much data you could buy. You know, it's like a massive big data set, and constantly these strings of data coming in, and you know, combined, it was really, really powerful stuff from a marketing perspective. We've got a call this week, haven't we, about it, Joe?
We do, yes. And I've asked you to come on because, like you said, you ran through it with me briefly, didn't you, the other day? But I'm not going to lie, it went over my head a little bit. I couldn't quite wrap my head around what a pixel was and what was now, happening.
Have we seen any regulatory action? I think we have, haven't we, on the use of cookies? I don't think there's as much as there is on the use of SMSs and outbound messaging without TPS, but I'm sure the ISO has probably taken action on cookies, have they or haven't they?
Have they not on Google in the past?
Back end of last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've noticed, to be fair, Google have improved their cookie banner, if you call it that, pop-up. You never used to be able to just accept and reject. Now you can. You'd have to unselect everything that you don't consent to. And they've changed that. So it made me think whether it was off the back of that or not. What Steph said in the chat.
Yeah, so Steph said that there is a payload. It's often like a hashed version of the email address, so that each user can be uniquely identified. I think that's often how. So Steph's much more technically advanced than I am, but I think that's often how it could work. So that you know that person, every time they do something, you know, with that email, open it again. Every time you do something with it, it's calling for this image to get served, which you can't see because it's a 1 pixel by 1 pixel clear image or something like that. Quite clever, really, you know, quite clever.
Mm. Complicated.
So, I don't know. So what else have we got to talk about on cookies then? I mean, you know, the rules about, you know, telling people cookies, have you already said this, Joe, the cookies are there, what they're doing, why they're there, and then consent.
Yeah. And obviously that the conditions for consent derive from Article 7 of the UK GDPR, which makes life a little bit easier, doesn't it, for us all?
Yeah. Yeah. So you don't have to keep asking for consent either. Once you've got it, you know, you would have to ask for it again if you changed some of the elements of what they're being used for, et cetera. But you don't have to keep going back asking for consent every time somebody visits your web page.
Yeah. I think it's worth also mentioning that obviously conditions for consent is that it's as easy to withdraw as it is to attain. So for people who have got websites, it's important to have, I think it's typically called a cookie cog. Am I right in thinking? That's what it's called for a user to alter their preferences in relation to cookies. Is that what they're called? Or have I just made that up?
I don't know what you
I was reading Bev's.
You look chiseled, Phil.
I was reading Bev's, appearing at Bev's.
Bev's it was. The ICO provides a good example of that on the website. They have a little cog in the bottom left-hand side of the corner of the website. And you can open that, you know, you can choose which cookies you consent to or don't consent to. But that's, you know, something else that we see a lot is that once you've pressed accept or reject or just even close whatever the website has, whether it's compliant or not, then sometimes it just disappears and you can't really get it back unless you delete them on your browser.
Which is a right chew, isn't it? I mean, deleting cookies on your browser is a right fast. That's definitely not as easy as to withdraw it as to give. So Bev's post is saying that there's another data protection network saying that the next big compensation claim will be directed at non-compliant website owners for not getting consent. And be interested to see how that one pans out, because you can't say, well, you know, is there any material harm, or, you know, there's a bit of hassle from having your data shared or loss of control, but be interested to see how that might be monetized.
Yeah, you're right. Just going back to the consent around cookies as well. Some things I see, do you know, when you go onto a website and a cookie banner pops up and it says, you know, do you consent to the cookies, or, you know, and it would say accept all. And then it doesn't give you a decline button, but it says manage preferences. To me, that's not as easy for me to withdraw as it is for them to attain the consent, because I've got to go manage preferences and then manually click each box.
Whereas,
to give the cookies, I can just press accept all as opposed to manually doing it. If it was both the same, then to me, that's, you know, that's valid. But if it's different, then I don't think that's valid consent.
No, it's interesting. There's some quite good tools around, but I mean, none of them really many of them don't complain. You could spend all day raising complaints for people about their websites and their cookie tools, because you're not meant to have differentiation of colours to make accept all stand out more than reject all. Mm. But people do, don't they? I mean, I'm always a reject all, object all. Reject
that's,
all, then
that's one thing that annoys me is when you have to you know, opt out of all these legitimate interests and consent to different cookies and whatever. And then you get to the bottom and you press the green button thinking it's save and close and it's accept all.
Yeah. So you spent half an hour.
Oh my gosh, I have to just put it down a second.
Yeah. I'm the same as you as well, Phil. I press reject all, but if it doesn't give me that option and it says manage preferences, I'll just click accept all because I'm lazy.
No, I don't. I'll spend half an hour going through unticking them all. Or I won't bother.
Because the principle of it, you know, you won't even care whether your cookies are being shared or, you know, your information, cookies are placed on your website or not. But it's just the principle of it being non-compliant and forcing you into it. Vicky said in the chat, Google seems to be tightening up on cookies in general. One of my clients received an email from Google stating that their website wasn't compliant with their terms and conditions and gave them a month to fix it. Essentially, they weren't telling the website visitors that they were using Google cookies.
And maybe the regulators taking action against Google is just kind of hit them hard, and then that'll ripple down, kind of ripple effect with other organizations. So maybe there's a kind of a strategy there. But yeah, I remember Vicky's client getting that. Actually, it's the first time I'd seen something like that from Google. We thought it was a wind up at first.
Yeah, they seem to have that tactic with a lot of stuff, don't they, with GDPR and PECA and you know, laws alike, that they take advantage, or they criticize the bigger organizations in order for it to cause a bit of a ripple effect that everyone else then kind of goes, oh, bloody hell, Google have had a big fine for this. We best sort our act out.
Yeah, yeah. I see quite good stuff in the chat as well on kind of vigilante letter going out and so on and so forth. But I mean, it's not just about cookies, is it, the PECA? You know, do you want to cover off some of the other aspects?
I've got quite a nice thing to nuance us into direct marketing, actually. It's a query I've had into support from one of our customers. They're looking to direct market out to people who have abandoned their order in the shopping basket. Obviously, I presume they will collect that data through a cookie, will tell them whether they've abandoned the purchase of a basket. Am I right in thinking
probably
that?
Probably. It'll be a process flow, and if you don't go to the payment page, then
So then off the back of that, they want to reach out to the people that abandoned those, and they've asked for the guidance around how to do that through telephone and how to do that through consent. Through electronic messages,
So an abandoned shopping cart is good grounds for a soft opt-in, isn't it?
Yes, that was my recommendation, yeah.
Yeah. So,
would you say so? If they've not purchased anything?
It's negotiation of a sale.
Oh, okay.
And the ICO believe that negotiation of a sale is if they've took an interest, an avid interest into a specific product, that's good enough to meet the term of negotiation of a sale.
Yeah, but when are they given the opportunity to opt out?
Well, there is conditions of soft opt-in under Regulation 22, paragraph 3.
Yeah.
Go on, Joe.
They've got to be given all relevant information and so on and so forth. But they don't, you don't have to have collected consent to then reach out to them and say, effectively, you know, you abandoned your basket. Similar products and services, isn't it?
Yeah, because usually you see, you know, if you make a purchase, then as you're pressing pay now, there'll be a little tick box above it that's probably pre-ticked saying, I allow this company to reach out to me with similar products in the future. Well, that's where you can already opt out.
Yeah, well, many times you're logged in, aren't you, as a logged in user, unless you're buying something as a guest. So you will have probably been through all that kind of sign up process already.
Can you assume that, though?
No, I can't. We can't assume it here, can we? But I mean, you know, it all depends on each individual case. But from what Joe was saying, that and in his particular case, you know, I will be start first of all looking at the soft opt-in, you know, and go exactly what you're doing, Jasmine, is going back through the process saying, right, okay, can we use a soft opt-in? Have we qualified all the various tick boxes? But you know, hopefully, you know, they've done things properly. And one of the things I was going to raise today, that, you know, the biggest issues we see or mistakes is people shooting themselves in the foot by not going through the proper process. Or even worse, you know, Vicky and I were looking at something last week where this particular organization had said, you know, I effectively consent to receiving 31 emails. Why 31 emails? You know, so after the 31st email, no consent. I only consented to receive 31 emails.
Did it specify what the emails were?
Well, it kind of gave an indication of what they were. You know, it's basically one a day for a month. That's what it was. But
okay,
when that month's over, you know, you haven't got consent anymore. So it's really, and you know, it was a charity as well. So you know, they're even less equipped to then start trying to, you know, maneuver with the soft opt-in, or because, you know, there are no purchases, there are no similar products and services. So, you know, it just requires, you know, some real careful consideration of what are we asking people to consent to, and making it clear, non-ambiguous, and, you know, and specific. But closing it off like that, you know, can cause you some future real headaches.
They're just adding burdensome to their activities, aren't they? Because if you just initially state you consent to all of them, then you don't have to collect it again until it's, well, I don't know. It depends on each case by case basis of when you have to collect the consent again, but that would be the right way to do it, would it not?
Sorry, I was reading the chat, Joe. I'm listening.
I'm just having a conversation with myself.
Michael's got his hand up, so Michael can interject at this point.
Yeah, you can have a conversation. We'll just read the chat.
I was just going to say that some people put like a year for consent. I mean, I haven't really seen anyone give a real reason to, because then maybe they've forgotten. So they get another email down the line, like you get with recruitment, don't you? They try and ask you if you still want to be on their website for a certain period. They don't always say how long, but that might work. Like, just like, you know, it might be like this common period that people do for DPIA sometimes, review them after a year or two. So at least it gives you time to check with them if they still understand what they're agreeing to and why. Or else, yeah, you're right. If you start bombarding them with emails every week or every month, they're going to be quite agitated and irritated, and then they'll try and take some other complaint against you or something.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it's quite tricky, isn't it? So, you know, I think you have to, again, worst things are to collect consent and then not communicate with people, because the longer that interval goes, and, you know, potentially less valid your consent. So, I do like working in the area of PEC. I think it's quite a fascinating, you know, place. But you also got to know the environment you're working in. So when I was working in sport, in football, you know, the fans, generally speaking, they actually do want to hear from the club. Yeah. But in other environments, you know, so you've got a much lower incident of complaint. In other environments, you know, it's much more, they're much more aggressive. And I think in our business, you know, we only do B2B work. But I mean, if we were trying to, you know, go B2C, you know, people are highly critical of us and how we conduct ourselves, quite rightly, you know, because we're there preaching, you should be doing it this way. And if we start doing it in a different way that's not compliant, then, you know, I think that has a negative impact, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Bev said in the chat, with many charities, they have bundled consent statements anyway. I can foresee someone making a purchase on a charity e-commerce site and receiving marketing for fundraising.
And that, again, that's a great point. So the ICO has actually changed their stance now. But when they, a few years ago, they were saying, remember, they fined 10 or 15, you know, big charities for not having consent. And then they said the soft opt-in could not be applicable to charities. But I always said, well, that's just, I'd love someone to test it, because some of our clients that are charities run shops, so they do sell commercial things. The restaurants, you know, some of the charities, and therefore they are, that aspect of it is a commercial venture. So why would they not be able to rely on the commercial elements of the soft opt-in? You know, why is it? I don't know why there is that commerciality to it, you know. And I asked ChatGPT actually before we came on.
Do you want to tell us or?
I will. I'm just trying to find it in my notes.
Well, I can have a little bit. I can add a little bit to that while you're trying to find it. I think no problem in doing that, Phil, as long as the soft opt-in is obviously for a similar target, a similar service or product. Sorry, you know, like Bev says, where they've bundled it into then onto fundraising. You know, that to me probably wouldn't be able to run the soft opt-in if you're going to switch it for something completely different. Say take the shop for example. If you've soft opt-in for the products you're selling in the shop, say clothes, if it's a charity shop, you then can't bundle that into the soft opt-in for fundraising because it's not a similar service.
No, I mean, he actually says you can't soft opt-in fundraising anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah. The soft opt-in for charities is under review, isn't it? I do wonder how far they'll go with it, if they'll stay with the stance on you can't use it for fundraising because people, you know, donate out of goodwill and whatnot, and whether it'll just be that commercial aspect. But
then again, if you're selling something in a charity shop like clothes, are you not, is the purpose for not to fundraise for the charity?
Yeah. It's just, you know, a different way about it. It is a donation, but it's still, you know, you're giving something
back
in return.
Yeah. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Did you find it?
Yeah, I mean,
he looks like
I did.
Yes.
Yeah, well, the ChatGPT reckoned. I mean, I'm just interested to see, you know, how, like we were saying earlier, you know, it's very interesting to think. Well, I wonder what he would say if I asked it this direct question. You know, why is a soft opt-in not available to charities under the PECA in the UK? And you know, it came back with saying that you know, charitable donations are motivated, as you just said there, by altruism and goodwill, and individuals may have different expectations regarding communication from charities compared to commercial entities. I'm not sure I agree with that, to be fair, but and it says by not allowing the charities to use a soft opt-in in the PECA aims to ensure that individuals have more control over the types of communication they receive from charitable organizations. So what I guess what they're saying is, you know, the motivation to donate, as you said, Jasmine, is goodwill, rather than you know, obtaining some kind of product, good or service for your payment.
I think, you know, if you still give the opportunity to opt out, you know, and you're transparent in how you're going to communicate with them and you know, just keep them up to date on how long you plan to communicate with them for, all of that kind of thing, then I don't see a problem with it. Although in the past, I don't think it happens anymore, but I remember, say, like if my parents when I was younger would donate to a charity and then they'd constantly receive, or they'd end up signing up to something, you know, for months and they constantly receive communications about it. And I remember that being a thing when I was younger.
Yeah, but you could opt out of it, couldn't you? I mean, again, I've got a big question about how intrusive is this. I don't like receiving, you know, tons of emails, only because it clogs up my inbox. I've then got to commit time to going through it all. But, you know, is it more intrusive than a phone call? Why are the rules about email marketing more stringent than they are around telephone marketing? Would you prefer to get an email that you can dismiss, or would you, or get hooked on the phone with someone trying to flog you something?
I think the difference is how easy it is to send multiple emails. You know, you can bombard someone, whereas you can only send, you know, obviously it depends on how many staff you've got in a call center or something, but you can only call one person at a time, so maybe that's the reason.
I think you're right, but I just don't find it any more intrusive.
Carry on. I was going to say, while you're on the topic of intrusiveness between emails and telephone, taking it back to that case I had with the shopping cart, they wanted both sides of the thing, whether email or telephone. And when I explained briefly around telephones, the rules around that and how you don't need consent in order to ring an individual for direct marketing purpose, I did say then, obviously, you'll need a lawful basis, which will be a legitimate interest in this case. Which I believed, you'll need to then carry out a legitimate interest assessment. And I think in there, in the purpose of doing an LIA, you'll probably see that telephone direct marketing would come across as intrusive, because you're getting a phone call off of an individual saying, I've seen that you've been in your shopping cart and you've abandoned the order. why have you done that? I think that comes across as quite intrusive.
Yeah, I think that to me, the human element, the human interaction is more intrusive than just getting a load of text on a page. I can just dismiss it.
Yeah,
no problem.
Because on a phone,
I
feel like they've been watching
it, no problem, yeah. What you were saying, Jasmine, was there's two different things there. One's the perceived intrusiveness of it, and the other thing is the effort that has to go into making the outbound communication in the first place. I'm not sure that should be relevant. I think that it should be much more about how intrusive it is.
Yeah, I guess it's what perspective Packer takes with that. It doesn't really specify, does it? But that's what I presume is the reason for the more stringent controls is the fact that it can be, it's much easier, it's much more accessible to send out multiple emails, and your inbox could end up being completely bombarded with marketing communications.
Well, I guess so. If the rules were the same, then you would receive a colossal number of inbound emails.
Yeah.
And the danger is you just lose the work ones you're looking for in your inbox. Another interesting one that comes up in relation to the Pecker is this notion of a corporate subscriber and an individual subscriber, mostly around email marketing again. So the rules are different for corporate subscribers, aren't they, to individual subscribers? So, the question that always arises is a business email address, a corporate subscriber or an individual subscriber? So that, again, that's something that comes up, because the rules are definitely different, aren't they? The ICO is very clear, which is really good when they clarified it, because it was a bit ambiguous in the past, but they clarified it a couple of years ago to say that you don't need consent to make outbound phone calls to businesses, and you don't need consent to send outbound unsolicited direct marketing emails to business, well, to corporate subscribers, but not all businesses are corporate subscribers.
And then that brings up the argument around LinkedIn, doesn't it? Because you're not always too sure whether they're on there for personal purposes or business purposes.
No, that's correct. Yeah, and again, I think the stance of the ICO is that they're more likely on there for personal purposes than business purposes, and therefore, in theory, emailing somebody an in-mail, whatever they call it, in LinkedIn, you would need consent for, but emailing them outside of the social media platform, you wouldn't.
So in that instance, you're okay to go on to LinkedIn, to use a software such as Cognizant to find their corporate email, to then email off the back of that. What's the difference between doing that than just messaging them directly through LinkedIn itself?
Well, that's a good question.
It's the same outcome, isn't it?
Well, it is. Yeah, it is. You're right.
I think it's a weak argument, to be honest, about the LinkedIn thing, because although, yes, you might have signed up with your personal email there, you're on there for for business purposes. It's a business platform. You're there to talk about work. So I don't see, and I think it's a culture on LinkedIn where people just accept that you're going to get direct marketing communications on there without giving prior consent. I think it's just accepted because you can't find everybody, I guess, can you?
No, that's right. But where do you draw the line? Which platforms are business oriented and which ones aren't?
Yeah, it's a fair question, but I think LinkedIn is kind of on its own, isn't it? I don't personally know any other platforms of a similar nature that are just for business purposes. I know people do put personal things on there, but I can't say I know what the tagline is of LinkedIn. But, in my eyes, it's business only, would you say, is the fundamental purpose of it?
I don't communicate with any of my friends. Well, of course, you guys are all friends, of course, but I don't use LinkedIn very well at all, actually. But what I don't use it for is communicate with family members or, friends about non-business related stuff. So, again, in my experience of using it is that it's a business platform for business relationships, whereas other social media platforms aren't. They're private for private discussions, or public for public announcements or whatever.
Yeah. Jasmine, you look like you're reading the chat.
Yeah, I am. I'm trying to keep up with it because there's different conversations going on. But there's a question for you, Joe. So what about taking the extracted email and uploading it into Facebook through customer audience?
I don't know what custom audience is.
Custom audience is when you could, again, I'm out a bit out off the pace with Facebook, but in the past you had your own CRM users or data subjects, whatever, that you knew were visited your Facebook page, and you could then use their profile to look for lookalikes, you know, people who look like them, same type of age, same type of demographic, same type of location, same type of interests. And then you could have a Facebook would build a custom audience, never share the data with you. They give you a count, like the 300,000 people that look like your customers. And anybody dive in and correct me if I'm wrong and well off the page with it, but that's how it kind of used to work. So you could then use your custom audience to try and extend out your marketing activities. But they never told you who was in that list. They allowed you to communicate with them via the platform, but you didn't have access to their data. So it's quite, again, big responsibility Facebook were taking on for controlling all that communication. I don't know if I might not have described that accurately, but that's how that's certainly how it used to work in the old days.
David said in the chat that the contractual agreement with LinkedIn provides consent. I'm not sure if that's, you know, just the choice of words or whether, you know, you give consent to, you know, to receive communications. If you want to clarify that, that's fine, David. But surely the consent wouldn't be freely given if you have to.
Why is it not freely given? You're entering into a contractual agreement to use LinkedIn. You can choose not to use LinkedIn. You're signing up to a service. You're taking a service from LinkedIn. That was our opinion. So we looked at it from that point of view, because what we looked at is there's an add-in called One Click Connect for LinkedIn, which basically allows. So if you're a big organization, your recruiters will predominantly be using LinkedIn. Therefore, you've got a lot of your recruitment in a secondary system away from your core system. And how do you stay on top of that? You keep secondary lists, which really isn't helpful from a privacy. One Click Connect is actually most of the major ATS or CRM systems, how you track your recruitment, allow you to almost click on the profile and import it into your system. Which at that point, everybody's thinking, that's a bit challenging from a privacy perspective. So that's what we did the deep dive on to see. And clearly LinkedIn think it's lawful. The big ATSs and CRMs think it lawful, but you always have to make your own position on this. So we looked at what's your outstanding purpose for doing it? Because they're not entering into a job because they don't even know. Yeah. And clearly they've thought it through. The One Click Connect has, you know, if you don't go in and acknowledge it, it has a removal period, so it will come out. So, you know, you've got a time bound period. We looked at, we saw it as lawful interest, as legitimate interest. I think the whole reason for LinkedIn, you look at the policies, what you're signing up to is a recruitment. It's a recruitment and business contact tool. That's what's stated in its terms and conditions that you're signing up to. So I don't think it's a big stretch to say that is the legitimate interest of the people on there. They're on there because they want you to reach out to them. You reach out to them. We then looked at, you know, the next thing you might be thinking about is if you've taken a copy of their information, how are they aware the process has them received a, and this is quite interesting for what you guys were saying, has you received an in-mail straight away? So you're actually getting contact to be told that Mondelez or whomever are processing your information at that point in time, because you get an in-mail to tell you. And then, like I say, if you don't react to it, the information gets deleted. And there's other really clever things to stop it. We can't use it anywhere else. So yes, it allows us to track, but it doesn't mean we can then use that in our other recruitment activities. And there, you know, that's actually most of the big players' response to how you handle that. Most of the sort of the major ATS and CRM systems that interface and work with LinkedIn have something similar around that space in how you would bring it in, how it manages and how it pushes it back. So for me, they've thought of most things, so the bit, you know, most of the bits you would challenge on, and you can make arguments either way, I'm sure, if you wanted to play devil's advocate. But looking from it, for a business that was by no means the first to look at doing this, you know, and you know, there's been no, as I'm aware, major legal challenges, and we did lots of searches for that kind of thing. There's no major challenges. We looked at it, and that was our stance around certain areas of it.
And does it? And it doesn't. To me, it doesn't seem unreasonable. You know, I've signed up for LinkedIn.
Yeah.
You know, and I get people reach out to me for, you know, asking if I'm interested in their services or jobs or, you know, whatever. And again, you kind of I expect it on LinkedIn.
And that's exactly it. That's part of your legitimate interest argument, isn't it? Legitimate interest is a bit that says, is this expected behaviour for that system? And I don't see how you could argue it wasn't. You know. If I'd signed up to Sainsbury's supermarket for for food and they suddenly started offering me jobs, I'm not sure I'd make the same
no,
connection.
I agree with you. Yeah,
but LinkedIn,
yeah,
different in my opinion.
So
anyway,
is it legitimate interest or consent?
We use legitimate interest for us to process it into them. There's no consent that we can show directly with them. The consent's with LinkedIn for that processing, for LinkedIn to share with us. Have we got consent from the third party? Nothing that I could show. So I didn't document under consent. I documented it under legitimate interest for us to do that small piece of processing. And then as soon as they join if they join the CRM, so candidate relationship management ongoing, where we just store them to consider them for future roles, then it would be consent and they can withdraw consent and come out of that. If we take them into ATS because they say, yes, I'd like to be considered for the role, then it goes under performance of a contract or actions to enter into a contract, and we'll keep it for a period of time that we've defined around that. So yeah,
it's just the electronic email direct marketing that you would require consent for. This is kind of talking about Pecker here, but I mean, it's just that aspect that's no option but consent, is there?
I think the LinkedIn bit is beginning to be a bit further away. The Facebook bit was quite interesting. I couldn't work out how they do some of that from what you were saying, but I've never really looked at that bit. So,
well, I haven't looked at it for a few years. I did this big piece of work for a big multinational FMCG company, and they were really wanted to get involved in all this. Really, it was quite clever. This is probably about 2010, so it's a long time ago. And it was quite an eye-opener, to be honest, as how much information was available and collected and how it's collected. And I've said before that this company has got a very, very limited target market, and they are very able to accurately target people based on medical information and lifestyle information and purchase history and travel history and loads of stuff coming in. Anyway, thank you very much. That was it. Steph's going to dive in. Thank you very much, Dave, for that.
Phil, I was going to talk about Facebook custom audience. And I think the thing that people have got to realize is that if you use some of these tools, you're entering into a controller to controller relationship. It's not a process relationship. And so what has happened, some of the stuff that's been recently in The Guardian, is you've got charities are putting stuff onto their website, which they're linking into Facebook. Now, what they do is they use SEO for things such as depression. If you're looking for depression, it's there so that you can find it. But what happens is that these tools automatically provide that information to Facebook. So you're going onto a site which might be depression, it might be weight loss, it might be something else. But if you've got this set up, you're automatically providing what could be classed as special category data to these third parties. And that's the issue that's come about from the stuff that's in the markup and also in the Guardian piece or the Observer piece. And it's the lack of awareness, I think somebody said earlier on, in terms of web developers, but also in terms of the web owner, who is the data controller. They're enabling this.
Mm. And then you get into remarketing, don't you, as well? So if you have been searching for something and you go on to a completely different website, all of a sudden, you've got relevant ads to what you've been searching for being served because it's being tracked and it's being remarketed at you.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff happening in the US, predominantly to do with health apps because of the rulings there in terms of what data people are providing to third parties. It's effectively a breach of data, which is related to the HIPAA regulation.
We could probably spend another half an hour just chatting about this type of stuff. Steph's got Steph's got his hand up. Jasmine, come on, what's any final thoughts? I mean, we're at 1:30 already. I can't believe we're at 1:30 already.
I know. No, it's been a good session. We could do a part two on this because there's a bit more to delve into, as always.
I think if we do a part two, I think we should look at some really fine-tuned specific use cases, like LinkedIn, like Facebook, like some other ones, and really try and get under the skin of how they're working and what they're doing. And as David, really well articulated, how you're doing different types of processing, and therefore, you might have different lawful grounds for each of those. The email marketing piece being one, the actual collecting of the data being another. Because I think unless you can break it down into those component parts, it just becomes a bit of an amorphous mess trying to figure it out. So
yeah, I'd like to unpick that LinkedIn one a little bit more, I think, actually. So I think that would be worthwhile on the next one.
Yeah, a data flow diagram, you know, a flow diagram of what's actually happening is really useful to me. You know, right, we're collecting the data. What, how's that legitimate interests? You know, how are we dealing with Article 14? Doing this with the automatic email out, right? How are we going to do unsolicited direct marketing? You know, how are we going to collect consent? You know, that is the nitty gritty, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we will do another session on that. We need to put one in the diary, but we'll let everyone know when that is.
I think Miles has penciled in 28th for the 7th. It's not permanent. It's not permanent. Well, he asked me, are we doing any part twos? And I said, more than likely tomorrow we'll probably overrun.
I think I'm on holiday on the 28th of the 7th.
Well, we can push it back.
Good luck.
Just me and Jasmine.
Have fun. Just you and Jazzo.
And David and Steph.
Yes, quite so.
Yeah, so thank you everyone for joining and for contributing as always. We'll see you next week for a GDPR radio session and have a great weekend. Thanks all.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
We have questions about this.